Hello and welcome to Forgotten Women, the feminist podcast that brings history to life. We're celebrating women who rebelled, protested and campaigned for social justice in 20th century Britain. So many activists, especially self-identifying women and non-binary folks, have been missed out of the history books, and we want to change that. In collaboration with Peer Productions, we are working with Bishopsgate Institute to delve into their archives to create these podcasts. Each of our episodes are recorded live in front of a studio audience, and each episode covers a different moment in history. This episode explores the life of Sophia Dulip Singh, who was a prominent suffragette who campaigned for women's rights in Britain. This is Forgotten Women, and we're making history. Sophia by Beverly Andrews.
Isn't Hampton Court beautiful? Wouldn't it be wonderful to live here, to be a real-life princess?
Maybe it wouldn't be the way you'd imagined it to be.
Why not?
Maybe you get bored being rescued by a prince.
No one could possibly get bored being rescued by a prince.
Maybe. They just might want to rescue themselves.
Oh, I don't know.
Irene, why are you walking like that?
My feet are hurting. Can we go home now?
Irene, you are such a ninny. Didn't I tell you to wear sensible shoes and that we would be walking a lot?
Yes, I know.
If you'd listened to me, your feet wouldn't be hurting now.
Yes, but she was hoping to attract the attention of some passing beau.
I was not. Take that back. That is absolutely not true.
Oh, Irene, look, there's a rather attractive man staring at you this very moment.
Where? Where?
Not interested, eh?
Oh, you too.
It's getting rather late. We'd better start making our way back to London now. But I cannot for the life of me seem to remember which way we need to walk to get the tram.
Why don't you ask that lady standing over there? What's the matter?
Nothing.
Well, it must be something, or else you'd be speaking to her now.
She looks...
She looks... What, Irene?
Well, she... She looks...
Well...
She looks...
Goodness, Irene, she looks what?
She looks foreign.
So?
We're just asking her for directions, Irene, not to move in. The worst thing she could do is send us the wrong way.
Oh, I don't think she would do that. Look at how she's dressed. She looks really wealthy.
Why would someone wealthy be selling a newspaper in front of Hampton Court?
It's because she's foreign. Foreign people do strange things.
Oh, do they now? Please inform us, Irene.
My uncle lives somewhere foreign, and he says they have very strange ways.
Your uncle does not live in a foreign country?
Yes, he does.
No, he does not.
He absolutely does too.
All right. So where does he live?
He lives in Wales.
Oh, Irene. I do worry about you sometimes. Were you asleep during Mrs. Crawley's geography class? Wales is not a foreign country. Wales is part of Great Britain.
Is it?
Yes, Irene, it is.
Why did I not know that before?
Oh, I have no idea.
I don't care. I just want to go home. Excuse me? But do you know where we can get the trams back to London? We've somehow lost our way.
Yes. If you follow the path just there, it will lead you to the main road. Once you're there, turn left and you will see the trams that take you back to London.
Thank you. Okay, it's just down this way. Annie, what are you... We need to get back.
Excuse me, but do you mind if I ask you a question?
No, not at all.
What is the newspaper you're selling there?
I'm selling the Suffragette. It's a newspaper about suffragettes. Would you like one?
Oh, no. No, I could not possibly take that.
Annie, what are you doing? We have to go.
What does it look like I'm doing? I'm talking to her.
I won't bite. You can talk to me directly.
I am sorry. I did not mean to be rude.
Your friend just wanted to know what I was selling. This is a newspaper that we produce called The Suffragette.
You are a suffragette.
My father says that only women who have a nervous condition are suffragettes.
Why, Irene, would they have to have a nervous condition to be a suffragette?
He says that if they were clear in their minds, they would see how good their lives are. They cook, they clean, and they have babies. What else could they possibly want? Why meddle in men's affairs?
Well, putting it that way, I cannot see why we would ever want it to change.
I assure you, I do not have a nervous condition, and yes, I am a suffragette.
But why are you selling it of all places in front of Hampton Court?
Because the people who live here are, I think, the ones who need to read it the most.
How would you know?
Because I live here too.
You live here?
Yes, I do.
But...
They allow foreign people to live here too.
I didn't mean to.
That's all right. Many of the people who live here are the widows, sons and daughters of those who ruled the empire. They are the ones who need to change the most, I think.
But how did you come to live here?
That is a long story, but if you like, I'm happy to tell it to you.
I have to get home now.
Me too. Are you coming?
No. You two go.
What are you going to do?
Stay. I want to speak with...
My name is Princess Sophia Duleep Singh.
You're a princess?
Yes.
But you don't look like a princess.
Maybe that's because your idea of what a princess should look like may be, how should I say, rather limited?
And a real princess would never be selling a newspaper outside Hampton Court.
I am a real royal princess, and I'm selling a newspaper outside Hampton Court.
But why?
Because, as I said, I think the people who live here need to read it the most.
But why?
Because they are all in some way connected to the men who built the empire. If we are to tear it down, they need to understand why.
But why would you want to tear down the empire? It's made us rich.
Are you rich?
Well, no, but...
The empire makes a small number of people very rich, whilst millions of others suffer because of it. If we are to change the empire as well as the society, women need to have the right to vote.
But why would you want to change society?
Because it is not fair to half the people who live in it. We live by the laws that are voted for by Parliament, and yet we have no say in who the men are who vote on them. I believe women should have the right to vote.
My father says if women had the right to vote, they'd stop having babies.
And why is that, Irene?
I don't know. We never explained that bit.
Maybe if I tell you my story, it might help you understand why some men think that way. It was a very strange journey that brought me here, but I am willing to share it with you, if you like.
I want to hear her story.
Annie, we have to go.
You two, please, go along without me.
All right, we will.
Please tell me your story.
Well, my story was shaped by my father's. He was born in a country far away. He was born in India, in the richest part of the country, the Punjab. He was their last royal leader, the last Maharaja.
What's a Maharaja?
I thought you were leaving.
I wanted to hear it too.
I'm happy to tell you all. I was saying to...
It's Annie. My name is Annie. This is Sally. And this is Irene.
I was just telling Annie that my father was the last Maharaja of the Punjab, which is a part of India.
Is that very far away?
Yes, Irene. It's further away than Wales.
That's far.
Yes, Irene. That is far. How did you get here?
I was born here.
I don't understand.
It is rather complicated, but because of all the fighting within the ruling family, my father came to the throne when he was only 5 years old. He was Maharaja Duleep Singh, and the last Maharaja of the Sikh Empire. His mother, my grandmother, the Maharani, was called Rani Jindan. Even today, she's admired as a great leader. It was custom in my country that when someone's husband dies, the wife commits sati.
Sati?
It is a practice in India whereby a widow throws herself onto her husband's funeral pyre.
That is horrible.
Yes, it is. But some in India viewed it as a kindness, since it meant that widows would not suffer the stigma of being left behind. But my grandmother refused to do it, saying her son needed her. Because my father was still a child, she ruled by his side as regent. The British Raj was greedy for land and saw an opportunity. They declared war on his kingdom and used bribery to encourage his military commanders to betray him. After the second defeat by the British, his beloved mother was exiled and imprisoned. He was then given a choice: either surrender his empire or lose the protection of the British crown. My father had no idea that those who put the choice to him were really his true enemies, the East India Company, who would profit from his vast empire after he was gone. My father, being so young and with no one to advise him, relinquished his empire and its vast wealth. He was then sent away and put under the tutelage of Dr. John Loggin.
Come here, dear boy.
Yes, sir.
With such strict instructions that meant no contact with his beloved mother, and none with any other Indians in private, even servants. Being young, my father grew to embrace all things English, eventually becoming a Christian. Stories of this once Sikh prince cutting his hair and becoming a Christian traveled to England, and the Queen requested his presence. Once at court, he found favor with her. He married my mother, whose own mother was from Abyssinia, and began his family. Due to my father's handsome looks and his refined manner, the Queen's favor continued, and she consented to become my godmother. My father might have been happy had two things not happened to remind him of all that he had lost.
What were they?
After 13 years, he was finally allowed to meet his beloved mother, who was now blind. She had been imprisoned and then exiled by the British. They met in Calcutta.
Mother?
Please, don't cry for me, my son.
Mother, your eyes.
What I cannot see, I can feel in my heart. Always remember who you are. You are the Maharaja of the Sikh Empire. Do not let anyone make you forget that.
Seeing his mother thus plunged my father into a spiraling depression, the Queen became concerned about Maharaja's melancholy.
I am worried. Our little Maharaja seems most unhappy.
Yes, Your Majesty. Many at court have remarked how changed he has become. They say it is the dark influence of his mother.
Perhaps. I worry that if we do not do something, we will lose him to her influence. I thought that if he was perhaps allowed to hold that great diamond which came from his homeland, he might again be happy. That in turn would make us most happy.
I think Your Majesty is very kind to have thought of this.
So with that, the Queen summoned guards to bring that great jewel to her. A diamond which should have been strapped to my father's arm as a mark of his station as the Maharaja of the Sikh Empire, not the possession of Queen Victoria. But this she could not see. She asked for my father to be sent for.
How are you today?
I am well, Your Majesty.
We are most worried about your melancholy, and thought that perhaps holding the Koh-i-Noor would help to mend this.
A servant handed my father the diamond, the jewel which represented the Sikh sovereignty. I think as he looked at it cradled in his hand, he began to see for the first time everything which had been taken away from him. The years his mother had spent either in prison or in exile. The wealth of his kingdom which belonged to his people that was now lost, drained away by the British Raj. It was as if he held his long-lost empire in his very hands.
Look, Your Majesty, he shakes violently. Should we not take the jewel from his hands?
No, it pleases us very much to see him hold it.
I think it is now time for me to return this to Your Majesty.
Maharaja, we are most happy to let you hold it a while longer.
No, Your Majesty. I am happy to return it to your care.
And with that, my father gave it back to the woman who saw herself as his sovereign. But I think that was the beginning of a deep wound opening within my father, and he was never the same again. He began to neglect his estates, and then once his mother died, even his family, in his quest to reclaim his ancestral lands. Converting back to his Sikh faith, he grew to hate everything the empire represented. He alienated all who had originally become his friends, including my godmother, Queen Victoria, and set out on a mad journey to India with our family to reclaim his kingdom. We arrived at Aden, where British spies who had followed us would not let us travel any further. My father was escorted off the boat in handcuffs. Eventually, it was decided that my father would send my mother, brothers, and sisters, and me, back to England. I will never forget how much older my father looked that day when he said goodbye.
Papa, I do not wish to go.
Sophia, this is not a choice that you have. I am ordering your mother, you, your sisters and brothers, to return to England.
But I do not understand why you will not come with us.
You are young, Sophia, and your life is filled with parties and finding someone you might love one day. When you are older, you will maybe understand me better and why I have done what I have done. For now, please know that I love you very much.
And with that, my father said goodbye, and I only saw him once more when my brother Victor was dying. Now a broken man, the British government relented and allowed my father briefly to return. He then left for Paris, where he died alone in a hotel room. I think it was my father's death and my older sister's rebellion that started my interest in India.
Rebellion?
She grew bored with the endless parties we were invited to attend as debutantes and decided she wanted to become a doctor. But at the time, it was almost impossible for a woman to become a doctor in Britain. So she moved to America, where she thought she could qualify, as there were schools that were just opening up to women there.
Did she qualify?
No. She started her course at a college which had opened its doors to women, but because a single board member objected, all the women who had enrolled had to leave.
That's not fair.
No. And there is much about women's lives which is not fair. My sister, feeling despondent, returned to England, and then eventually went to live in India, our father's home. Eventually, she asked me to travel there, and I said yes.
What was it like? Was it exotic?
Was it beautiful? Was it the way you imagined it?
Yes, it was. And it wasn't.
I do not understand.
When one feels as if they are a guest in their own country, it is not a happy experience. I travelled there after the Great Famine. A famine which, although had not been caused by the plundering of the British, its worst consequences had been exacerbated by their woefully inadequate response to it. Estimates of the number of people who died are around 18 million.
18 million?
Perhaps more. No one will ever know the exact figure. Added to this, because the Queen had recently died, the country was being asked to spend vast sums of money to celebrate the new monarch's arrival on the throne. For many years, the British government did everything it could to prevent me from visiting India. But with all the fanfare surrounding the royal coronation, I was eventually allowed to go. But, of course, with official disapproval. Something we saw when we attended official events, hosted by British officials in a land which should have been our own.
So, let me look at you and see if you look presentable.
I miss this.
What?
Having an older sister to look after me.
Turn around. I suppose you'll do. I guess there are social norms we have to conform to.
For someone who hates the British, I am rather surprised to hear you say that.
I want you to have a good time whilst you are here. That way, you might just consider staying. If me being nice to the British will help that happen, then it is a very small price to pay. Hurry, we should leave or we will be late.
Bambi, are you not changing?
Why?
You...
I am wearing traditional dress. What of it?
You know, they disapprove of...
I will wear what I please in my own country.
But they do not like...
Don't like what, Sophia? What? They don't like us dressing as what we are?
I didn't know what to say to my sister, since she was, of course, right. Should we not dress as we please? We were in a country, part of which my family once ruled. The whole situation seemed absurd. We were driven to the official engagement, my sister in traditional dress, whilst I was wearing an evening gown. I very quickly found out what it was to encounter British disapproval.
Lady Cooley, I would like to introduce my sister, Princess Sophia.
The weather is rather beastly this time of year, wouldn't you say? I simply do not understand how these people cope with it.
Oh, Mrs. Cabela's, I would like to introduce...
Ah, Lady Coley, how are you and your husband settling in? I hope well, but please do let me know if there is anything my husband and I can do to help. Getting adequate staff in this country can be a trying affair, but it's Not impossible if one has some help.
My sister and I stood there mortified, not just because of their rudeness, but in the knowledge that this was not happening on some English estate, but in the country of our father's birth, where he once ruled. Our wealth from my father's empire would have dwarfed all those in that room combined, and yet we were the ones treated as outsiders. Later, I overheard a conversation with the British Viceroy, who had just given an address to a graduating class of Indian students.
I told them, those dear boys, that the Queen was most proud of their progress, but that it was most important for them to keep clear-headed in their hopes for the future, to clearly see what was possible and what was not, and not to fall prey to the rabble-rousers who seem to be appearing in this country. I told them that the British Raj needed their expertise in local affairs, but the running of the country needed to be kept firmly in the hands of those who knew what was best for India and kept her best interests at heart.
Later that night, my sister and I argued.
You saw yourself how they treated us. How can you defend them?
Bambi, not all the English are like that.
Sophia, when will you open your eyes to what they really are? When will you see all that they have taken from us, from our entire family? I will never, ever forgive them for what they have done. I hope they all go to hell.
I chose to leave the room before we both said things we would regret. The way we were treated that night by the British was appalling, and in such contrast to the way we were treated by those whose country it was. Everywhere Bambi and I had gone, Indians surrounded us, shouting our names.
What did they?
Maharaja Daleep Singh de Bacche!
We could also see the rising anger in their eyes. I was determined, though, that there had to be a better way. A better way to change things. When I left for India, my life consisted of going to social engagements. I never read the newspapers, nor looked clearly at the outside world. Although we were wards of the Queen, and as such were put on a stipend by the Queen, it was only a tiny percentage of what had been taken away, not simply from my family, but from all the people of the Punjab. Before I left India, plague had started to grip the country. I am sure this was propelled by the fact its people were already in a weakened state. But I was determined not to let hatred of the British act as poison in my veins, but for it to find a positive outlet. On the ship back, despite the fact that the classes were strictly segregated, and it was easy to travel in first class without noticing the hardship of those who travelled in steerage, it was harder to ignore the Lascars.
Lascars?
They were the seamen who were often hired by the East India Company to man the ships for them as they sailed goods from India to the British Empire. They were often young, from poor rural communities in India, and were treated appallingly on the ships they worked on. One man, who sailed on my boat, had many of his front teeth knocked out because, on the orders of his captain, he was beaten in the face for a minor offence. His story was not that different from others who worked the boats. Once docked, these men were simply abandoned with little money to keep them alive until they found work again, on another boat. This left them living in appalling conditions near the city's docks. When I returned, I started to campaign to raise money for their care. And then I met someone who would change my life forever. A friend who, like me, had spent much of her time before living the life of a debutante.
Oh, Sophia.
What?
Oh, Sophia, I am transported.
Will you please explain to me what you...
I have heard such words. I do not know if I can do them justice.
Una, will you please calm down and just explain to me?
Sophia, I have met the most wonderful woman who has opened my eyes to all that is wrong in this world. And you will meet her, too. After hearing her speak, she made me see what I have been blind to before.
Una, please, just...
After hearing her speak, I just kept thinking of all the time I have wasted in my life. I used to think a woman's life was simply to first be an obedient daughter and then a dutiful wife. I see now how foolish those thoughts were. Oh, Sophia, we are so much more. Listening to her speak, I now see that not only can we change our lives, we can change the world. I really see that now.
Una, who on earth are you speaking
of? All the women there who heard her speak were as galvanized as I have been, and together we will do so much.
Una, for heaven's sake, Will you calm down and tell me who it is you are speaking of?
Sophia. Sorry, I get so carried away when I speak of her.
So who is this woman?
Her name is Emmeline Pankhurst.
She's the woman the papers write about. They say that she is a danger to the country.
Sophia, open your eyes. Who writes those articles? Who owns the papers they are published in? Men. People will only hear her words clearly when we have our own paper.
Our own newspaper?
Yes. A paper that will promote the cause of women's suffrage. Sophia, do you not see? The world will not change until we women have a say in the laws that are created to govern us. Until that happens, then the injustices that we see around us will simply remain the same.
But that can never happen, surely.
It can. And it will happen. And then we will dismantle this world where poor women are locked into workhouses run by men, with no protection, nor say in how they are treated. You told me of the horrors you saw in India committed in the name of the crown. We will change that. We will change everything. I never saw these things before, since they did not affect my life. But now I see that if one woman suffers, then that woman is not alone. We all suffer. Don't you see? It affects all of us. We are that poor woman condemned to the horrors of the workhouse. We are that poor Indian village woman whose child has died from famine because the grain that should have been used to feed him was shipped to our shores. Why should a woman, when she marries, pledge to obey her husband? Yet he does not pledge to obey her.
I do not know. I suppose because it has always been done that way.
Well, now it is time to change. Sophia, will you not come and hear her speak?
Una, if it means that you will come to your senses, I'm happy to go. As long as you promise me one thing.
What's that?
If I go, you promise to never speak of the woman any more.
That is an easy promise to make.
Why is that easy?
Because I know you will be as moved as I, once you hear her speak. Oh, Sophia, let us go.
Where?
She is speaking again today. Please just come with me. Please.
Yes, I will come. There was no possibility of saying no to Una in the state she was in that day, so I agreed to go along with her. And I heard Emmeline Pankhurst speak for the very first time. It's strange, since I cannot clearly remember now what exactly she said. Only that day changed my life. It was as if sunrise had appeared after a very dark, rainy day. A light I had spent all my life until that point searching for. I was clear now what I needed to do with my life, how I would change the world. So I threw myself into every event that was arranged.
Thank you, ladies. That concludes our meeting for today.
First, I raised money for the Women's Social and Political Union, the organisation which suffragettes had created. I was able to get many I knew to contribute, not because they believed in our cause, but in many cases because a daughter, a wife, or a niece was now involved. And many gave willingly, since the views of some in society were gradually starting to change. But there were others who were implacable enemies. One was the former Viceroy of India, George Nathaniel Curzon, who, in many ways, wanted to keep women in their place, in the same way he wanted to keep Indians in theirs. The other was Horatio Herbert Kitchener, a brutal colonialist who, during the Boer War, set up concentration camps in South Africa, where women, children and the elderly, due to the lack of food and poor sanitation, were left to starve to death. For him, it was simply a tactic he used to cripple the resistance of the Boers. A young woman, Emily Hobhouse, a rector's daughter, alerted the world to the horrors of the camps, something he never forgave her for, and he associated all suffragettes with her actions. Now both men had returned to England and hated the new suffragette movement. They would do anything to see it crushed. These men, in their hatred of us, were joined by the Prime Minister Herbert Asquith. These opposing forces collided on Black Friday, a notorious day which will go down in history. Many looked to Parliament to see if the Conciliation Bill would pass, a bill which would have given at least a limited number of women the right to vote. When this bill failed, many felt it was due to the intervention of Prime Minister Asquith. A meeting was called by Emmeline Pankhurst, where she declared,
I will go to the House of Commons and batter down the doors.
I will go with you.
I will go with you.
We will go with you.
On the 18th of November, it was decided that we would march from Caxton Hall to the Houses of Parliament. The police orders issued by then Home Secretary Winston Churchill was to use all means necessary to stop us. We were on a collision course with the government, something we had no idea of. We began the march that day, and at first all seemed calm. Those who were present included Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, the country's first female doctor. There were women from all backgrounds and of all ages, some in their 70s, all marching for the right for women to vote, including Georgina Solomon, who was a widow of the South African statesman Saul Solomon. Her and her husband were fierce advocates for racial equality in South Africa. We had decided to march in groups, so if one group was stopped, another might get through. Our marching groups were surrounded by police, some mounted, as well as crowds of men. Although we tried to appear calm inside, we were all very afraid of what might happen. In the beginning, we thought we might actually reach the steps of Parliament, but then a group of policemen closed in, pushing and jostling us. The women, though, kept whispering words of encouragement to each other.
Is all well with you?
Yes.
Then be strong. Be strong and we will win.
There was an eerie silence as we approached. And then everything changed when the police closed in.
Get back!
Of course, there was nowhere to move to. I was trapped with a small group at St. Stephen's Gate. I was forced to watch as others were attacked. Mounted police literally rode into the crowd, knocking women onto the ground.
There, a woman is punched in the face.
There, a policeman throws a woman to the ground.
There, a woman fallen is kicked by a male bystander.
There, another woman has her breast first grabbed, then hit.
There, a woman is lying unconscious, covered in blood on the ground.
There, a woman tries to run to her aid, but is grabbed by a man.
Get off me, I said get off!
I watched, not believing what I saw that day. Women were assaulted by both policemen and male bystanders. All the women who were there had experiences they will never forget. Many had men repeatedly grabbing or punching their breasts. Looking back now on the degree of sexual molestation and physical violence which rained down on all of the women present that day, it was as if something dark had possessed many of the men who took part. A collective hatred rose up in them like some sort of demon. Not all the bystanders were intent on harm. There were some who tried to help and did pull unconscious, bleeding women out of harm's way. But there were others who encouraged men to commit sexual assault. It was rumoured that the worst assailants were undercover police officers, hoping to attract the merit of their superiors through their actions of state-sponsored cruelty. I finally managed to push past the police officer who had penned us to the gate and ran into the mayhem. A mounted police officer grabbed me by the arm until I thought it would break. What struck me that day was not the violence, but that no matter how often women were punched or kicked, no matter how many times they were knocked to the ground, they would get back up again and again. It was as if despite the winds which blew against us, our resolve was not broken, simply hardened.
Can you stand, sister?
Yes. I think I can.
Then stand so they can see they have not defeated us. That's it. Show them what we're made of.
The mayhem lasted for 6 hours before the police, instead of trying to stop women reaching the Houses of Commons, changed tactics and simply arrested everyone there. The next day arrived, and to our surprise, we found that all the charges had been dropped. We all suspected it was done because they didn't want women testifying about the level of violence they had witnessed. And although women did not appear in court, the government could not prevent their accounts of that terrible day appearing. The government tried to suppress photographs of the carnage, but they appeared in the newspapers nevertheless. Even those who were not in favour of women's suffrage were shocked. The accounts of the sexual violence which took place, a level of violence which could not have taken place without the consent of those higher up, was shocking. There were demands for a public inquiry. I wrote an official letter of complaint, but all to no avail.
Send her no further replies.
Churchill refused an official examination into the affair, and it was later ruled that one was not needed since excessive force had not been used. Although I continued to write, I did not receive an official response. From that point, I looked for other ways to support the cause. When the census was being taken, I refused to fill in the form and simply wrote, "No vote, no census." I, along with others, expected to be arrested. But the government by now was afraid of further hunger strikes, so avoided any further persecutions. I then stopped paying the licenses for my dogs. I received letters stating that I faced fines and a court hearing. I refused to attend the courts, and in turn, bailiffs were sent to my home.
Were you not afraid that you'd be arrested?
I wanted to be arrested.
But why would you want that?
To highlight our cause. The goddaughter of Queen Victoria on hunger strike would attract the attention of the world's press, something the authorities did not want. I had also heard from suffragettes about the tortures they had endured in prison being force-fed. I didn't think it was fair that they had experienced this and I had not. When the bailiffs came, they forced their way in, rummaged through my jewelry box, and took an expensive piece which was sent to auction. On the day of the auction, the WSPU would fill every seat.
Today we have an item from Queen Victoria's goddaughter. This item is this blue brooch.
Everyone would wait until the piece had reached the lowest possible amount, and then they would simply buy it back and give it back to me.
Going for 8 shillings. 6 shillings. Do I have 6? 4. 4 shillings. 2 shillings.
Here.
And sold to the woman in the green and purple hat.
Since I cannot seem to find a way to be arrested, I sell the suffragette here on the doorsteps of those connected to the ones in power.
You're all so brave.
It is easy to be when you believe in a cause.
I don't understand why the police would behave in that way, or why other men in general would do this. To beat a woman senseless simply because she wants to vote.
Change scares people. They're afraid that it will destroy the world they know, so they do whatever they can to stop it.
Even if it means hurting women.
I think on Black Friday they no longer saw us as being women. They saw us as being something they pledged to fight against. Nobody died on that day, but later one woman died because of the injuries she sustained. And on that day, I pledged that I would do whatever it took to get women the vote. Sometime later, I determined our voices would be heard. On the day of the King's speech, I marked what would be the journey of the Prime Minister's car and decided to run in front of it with a piece of paper which simply read, "Votes for Women."
Goodness, did he stop?
Only momentarily, before the police dragged me away. It was a pity. I would have liked to have had a word with him.
What would you have said?
That you cannot have a happy and fair society until women have an equal say in how it is governed. I'm not sure he would have been very happy to have heard those words.
It's getting late. We should go.
Yes, you should go now.
Thank you for speaking to us.
I've enjoyed speaking with you. And perhaps if you come again to Hampton Court, it will not appear so strange seeing me standing here selling the suffragette. I would be most happy if you stopped and said hello.
Of course we will.
I think, when I see you all here, I realise that I'm standing here now, so when you are my age, you will not have to. Now you should go, or your families will start to worry.
Yes, we should.
Oh, and the tram is just that way.
Thank you.
Annie, what are you doing?
I'm standing here for myself. The princess doesn't need to do this for me. I can do it for myself.
We're leaving now.
I know.
You're going to get into trouble for being late.
I don't care.
You will when you see your father. All right, suit yourself. Irene, let's go. Irene, what exactly are you doing?
I'm standing here for myself.
Do you even know how to spell suffragette?
No, but it doesn't mean I can't be one.
Fine. You have both taken leave of your senses. I'm leaving now.
I thought you said you were leaving.
If we're going to get into trouble, we might as well do it together. Votes for women!
Votes for women!
Votes for women!
Votes for women, now!
see more of the project, including the actors involved, please visit our website, www.forgottenwomen.co.uk. Thank you very much for listening. We would really love it if you could rate, review, and subscribe to help other people find the podcast.